The Pat Kenny Show
with Mater Private Network
on News Talk.
Health Minister Stephen Donnelly, good morning and welcome.
Good morning, Pat. Thanks for having me on.
Normally we start with the bad news, but we're going to start with some good news today for the parents of sick children.
That's right. So from this morning, from today, the acute inpatient paediatric hospital charges, the children's hospital charges, if your child has to go into hospital, are being abolished. So what they have been is if your child has to go in for a procedure, if your child is in overnight, the parents are charged €80 for that, up to a maximum of €800 a year. We are looking to reduce the cost of living, reduce the cost of healthcare. So this is the third of four measures for this year that we're bringing in. It's good news, and it's been well received by the parents affected. Mm.
Okay, what are the other three then?
So in the last 2 weeks, we have made contraception free for young women from 17 to 25. That's the first step. Obviously, we want to go further than that. We've had a very big reduction in the drug payment scheme. So the maximum anyone pays per month for their pharmaceuticals has been reduced from €114 to €80. Today is the third measure. That's the abolition of the children's hospital charges. And then the fourth one will be GP cards for 6 and 7 year olds.
How much is this costing the Exchequer? You know, it could be big money, it could be small money. And if it's small money, people will be asking why you didn't do it before.
A lot of the measures do cost quite a lot. So one of the measures I'm really proudest of is free contraception, which we've brought in 17 to 25 year olds. This year, there's €9 million allocated to that. But the full year cost for next year is €26 million. Now, to put that in perspective, that's the same amount of money as new developments for the entire National Cancer Strategy and the entire National Maternity Strategy combined. So these are important things to do. We are on our way to universal healthcare. That means healthcare that is free or affordable at the point of use for everybody. But it is an expensive thing to do. And so you have to phase it in over several years.
Now, we started with the good news about the paediatric charges in the children's hospitals. But it also brings into focus the children's hospital, which is massively over budget, it would appear. I mean, it should have cost half a billion. It's going to cost at least €1.5 billion. I mean, isn't it going to be, however wonderful it is, a monument to incompetence?
I think the financial situation has been discussed at length, and I've been on the record now that I've been very clear. I've been very critical of that for many years.
In opposition, you were very critical.
Yeah, in opposition, and I'm happy to restate the position. I don't believe that the financial management of it was done properly. That has always been my position. What I would say is, given that we know that and we have gone into that in great detail, what I would say is I was in the children's hospital recently. I had a long walk around it. And when it is open, the difference that it is going to make to children and to their families will be incalculable. We will have a national children's hospital and national children's services that will be the envy of the world. And putting aside the financial aspect, which I'm not diminishing, I'm accepting that that is the case. But what I've got to focus on is I've got to focus on delivering the hospital and getting the services open for children and their families.
Do you have concerns, and I'm sure the HSE has concerns, you know, you want the very best of staff to be available. And of course, there will be the transfer of staffs from the other hospitals, but you'll need more. You'll also need highly qualified nursing staff. And the question will be, given emigration and so on, we're told a lot of the nursing graduates graduating just at the moment are going to skedaddle off. Because they can't afford to live close to the children's hospital.
One of the many benefits of the new hospital is going to be, it'll be a very attractive place for people to work. So Children's Health Ireland, which is the three hospitals at the moment, they're increasing their staff at the moment. They're reducing their waiting lists at the moment. They really are doing very good work. They've opened the two satellites now, the emergency medicine satellites, which actually I have availed of. I opened one of them and then immediately availed of it as a parent. I was back in with one of my own kids. One of the things that is going to make it easier to hire all of these people that you quite rightly say we need is they will be working in an absolutely world-class hospital.
But where will they live? There's no parking for them. So even if you're coming on shift at 6 in the morning and there's no public transport, what are they to do? Because if you're suggesting they live in the general area around the hospital, the rents there are going to go sky high because there'll be a huge demand. if they're living in the hinterland, they'll need to get there somehow and they won't have parking for their cars.
Yeah, there's no doubt that there is a serious issue, a serious crisis, not just in terms, as you rightly say, Pat, of the cost of rental, the cost of buying a place, but also just the availability of it. The Housing for All plan is set to deliver, I think, about 25,000 homes. We need more. We need to be moving up to 35,000 a year. That is the government's plan. And ultimately, we have to make it affordable to live in and around the city centres for exactly the reasons that you've just
given. Do you anticipate, as the INMO want, that you'll have to pay a city allowance to make it affordable for people? In other words, if you're working in Tullamore, you don't get it. If you're working in Dublin or Galway, you do.
What I've asked various hospitals to do and what I've asked the HSE to do is, particularly where there are bottlenecks in recruitment. So let's say some hospital just can't hire paediatric nurses or theatre staff or whatever it may be, to be creative. In some cases, is it transport? In other cases, should the hospitals be doing what they did in the past, which is actually have accommodation for some of their staff? For foreign workers.
So do you see things like
in,
I see every morning, 7 o'clock in the morning, I see the Microsoft bus, the executive bus, delivering people to that particular company. Is that what you might envisage, that there would be buses touring the hinterland picking up nursing staff?
Well, I think what we've got to do is we've got to give the local hospitals and ultimately the six regions that we're moving to the freedom locally to solve their problems, because the solutions are different in Letterkenny to the National Children's Hospital. One thing I would say about the James's site, it's there now. There's no point revisiting whether it should have been or not, but it is there. It is well served by public transport. So that is one advantage of it.
When the transport is running.
Yes, when the transport is running, sure. But it's a big site with good public transport links.
One of the things that has become a relic of the past has been the nursing home. And I don't mean the caring nursing home for sick people or elderly people. I'm talking about the place where the nurses lived. It seems to recommend itself once again, that particularly for young nursing staff and young doctors and so on, that to have residences like they have in universities would be a very good idea. Affordable, make it very attractive, great social mixing and all the rest of it, lifestyle choices.
Yeah, I think it is a good idea. University Hospital Galway had a big block. There was a nursing residential block. It's now an administrative block. The Rotunda, I was there recently, were showing me where they had it. And I think they were looking at plans to do exactly this, to begin fitting it out again. I think for younger healthcare workers, for workers coming into the country. We hire a lot of foreign workers into the country. I think we should be looking at these things.
Now, let's talk about what's looming, because we've been talking about a twindemic. This is the kind of catchy news headline. And this is about the flu and some variant of COVID, whether it's BA5 or its descendant, that may descend upon us. So what's the vaccine prospect for flu and for COVID for the winter?
Can I say, first of all, Ireland has done well on vaccines. The HSE has done well on vaccines. The GPs, the pharmacists have really stepped up. But most importantly, the Irish people have done incredibly well. I was at a meeting of EU health ministers a few weeks ago in Europe, and many of them are looking very enviously at the vaccine rates in Ireland. And I think it's something we need to maintain and not lose sight of and never take for granted. On Monday week, the 3rd of October, is the next big push. We're launching the flu vaccine. We're also launching third boosters, third COVID vaccines for anyone 65 and above or 12 and above higher risk immunocompromised. And for the COVID vaccines, we're moving on that day to these new so-called bivalent vaccines, which is the one that was adapted specifically for the Omicron variant or variants, which Eimear Cook, I was talking to her recently on this. She's the head of the European Medicines Agency. She says it's a little better. It's not a game changer. She thinks it's about 5% better, but nonetheless, every bit helps. So the next big push now, Monday week, 3rd of October, flu vaccine is free for an awful lot of groups. The COVID vaccine is free for everybody. And really, My ask and the ask of our public health workers to all of your listeners, Pat, is for everybody to go and get the COVID vaccine, get the flu vaccine.
Now, we know there has been an issue in hospitals over the years of hospital workers not getting the flu vaccine, never mind the COVID vaccine. You know, it seems unconscionable that because the flu can ambush you very quickly. One day you don't have it, the next day you have it, which means that the day before you might have been coughing and sneezing at people in your workplace.
Yeah.
It seems unconscionable that healthcare workers should not be insisted upon getting the vaccine.
We need all healthcare workers to get the vaccine. Now, there's never been compulsory vaccination in Ireland, and it's not something that we are entertaining. There's been a lot of work done hospital by hospital on getting the rates open, and some hospitals they've done extremely well. It has been rising quite a lot over the years. This year, Pat, it's more important than ever, because this year we're facing a perfect storm. The Australians are dealing with it. They're dealing with it in New Zealand and other hemispheres.
What has
hemisphere
been their
teams.
Experience? You've obviously been getting intelligence from the Antipodes about how they're coping. What are they experiencing in flu terms?
What they're experiencing is a combination of COVID, both the direct health effects of COVID and delayed presentations because of COVID, RSV, other respiratory illnesses. They've had a very severe flu season. A lot of people have got sick. A lot of people have ended up in hospital. A lot of people have died. What we're planning for, and what we've been planning for right through the year, is a very difficult winter where we potentially deal with COVID, flu, RSV, and other pressures all at the same time, as well as historically high presentations, delayed presentations because of COVID. And all of that has to be managed by a healthcare system, by our incredible healthcare workers. But no matter how incredible they are, they have been battered and stressed for 2.5 years now. So it's going to be a difficult winter. We're putting a huge amount of effort and resources in place. And the single most important thing that we can all do as members of the public is to get vaccinated.
Now, the INMO and the General Secretary, Phil Nye, was on News Talk Breakfast, and she is concerned that Irish hospitals simply won't cope. And she wants all sorts of help given to keep patients safe. Mm. One of the things that she could do as General Secretary is call on all her members to get vaccinated.
Well, I
think she does, actually.
I think they may, in fairness.
But they need to kind of stress that as a union, that this is an imperative.
Yeah, and they well may, and the other unions may as well. Certainly, there's a lot of focus on it within the HSE. Obviously, that would be a matter for each of the unions, but it would be very helpful. Mm.
What they also want is the mobilisation of the private hospitals once again, as you did during the COVID outbreak. But they're saying it is unacceptable that elective procedures should be deferred and deferred and deferred when we are swamped by this twindemic in the winter. So now's the time to be doing the deals or potential deals with the private hospitals to keep the elective business going.
That's right. I met with the HSE last night and reiterated the point, the government's position, and the HSE is going to implement this, that all private capacity in the country needs to be used that we can get for public patients. We're talking about...
Can you ordain that, or is it down to the HSE itself, the management? Because, I mean, we'll talk about Navan Hospital in a moment. Like, you would like something to happen. They decide that something else is going to happen. So that relationship, the political relationship with the management is, I would suggest, a tricky one.
The HSE perfectly understand the private sector capacity, and to their credit, through COVID, it was used. So we had these so-called safety net agreements. That has now expired, but there is a good relationship between the public and the private systems. What I reiterated to the HSE last night was we need to be using every private bed, every private MRI, DEXA scanner, X-ray, nursing home bed, community bed. This winter requires the mobilisation of the entire healthcare system, the public and the private system.
So how does that mobilisation take place? I mean, we're talking about the 3rd of October as vaccination day, if you like. When do you mobilise? The rest, you're talking about doing it, but at what point does the crisis become so obvious and acute that you say this is mobilisation day?
Well, that has happened, right? So the HSE is already using private beds, private operating theatres, We have a scheme in place called GP Access to Diagnostics, where they're accessing private facilities. So your GP now, for the first time, rather than referring their patient to, you know, a hospital where they might wait for 6 months for an MRI, can now refer their patient directly for MRI.
And that will be paid for by the HSE?
By the state.
By the
government, yeah.
What about ambulances? There's a scandal, really, ambulance drivers saying, you know, we're being called out for hangovers and shaving cuts. Come on.
Yeah, well,
that there needs to be some sort of, at the point of call, some sort of triage to stop wasting ambulance time.
There is. And actually, the dispatch centre is in Talla, and I was there a few weeks ago, and really it's very, very advanced. In fact, I listened in on a call of a patient who was dealing with a very distressing situation. We have an expert team in the dispatch centre in Talla doing a lot of this triage, and the National Ambulance Service are going one step further. They're now introducing something they're calling hear and treat. In other words, you have people on the phone. They now have nurses and doctors in the centre as well. And what they're trying to do ultimately is see if an ambulance is needed at all. Certainly, based on the team I saw, there's no one who cut themselves shaving would be entertained in terms of having an ambulance sent out to them.
But the nature of the triage, for example, you know, my own experience, dreadful experience in St. Vincent's Hospital with my daughter during the summer, it doesn't give me great optimism for how things will be in the winter, was that people were kept overnight and not treated at all. And a good triage service would say, listen, missus, stay put, because if you come in here, we're not going to do anything to you. You'll just be sitting in a chair for 12 hours and we might see you tomorrow. So would you not be better off putting up with this discomfort for, 12 hours at home rather than sitting on a chair for 12 hours? I mean, that needs to be, the truth needs to be told as well, that you have no expectation of appropriate treatment in a timely fashion if you're brought in, even by ambulance.
Yeah, that does need to happen. A lot of the emergency departments are doing it. They have triage nurses. They have intervention teams. So what they're doing is spotting people who are coming in who clearly need help, but probably need to be brought home and stabilized and supported at home. They don't need to be in an emergency department. Yeah. They're not sort
especially
of
if nothing's
leading
happening.
Out. Exactly. One of the things that we're changing, Pat, is having senior decision makers, but really by which I mean consultants, on the floor at least 16 hours a day, 7 days a week. So one of the things I've experienced when I've gone into the emergency department, say at 11 or 12 o'clock at night, you have a lot of patients on trolleys, a lot of patients waiting on a decision as to whether they're to be admitted or whether they can be sent home. But there's no consultant there because we historically haven't had enough emergency medicine consultants. So I've sanctioned recently an extra 51 consultants to go into hospitals around the country. That's a start. We need to go further than that. But what we need is, if patients are coming in at 11 o'clock, 12 o'clock at night, 1 o'clock in the morning, it's all well and good that there is a junior doctor there and they're working very hard. But ultimately, it's the emergency medicine consultants can make those decisions better than anybody. Yeah. And that's why we're increasing those numbers.
My concern was obviously with my daughter who fell, banged her head, blood flowing, concussed, was knocked out for several minutes and right throughout the night was not checked for vital signs. You know, I mean, they said you'll get a scan in the morning, by which time, happily, she was not, but she could have been dead from a bleed on the brain. I mean, and then a doctor has the effrontery to say to my wife, when the bandage was taken off to, and my daughter said, please put it back on because it eases the discomfort. He handed her a fresh bandage, says, do it yourself.
Well, that doesn't sound.
I know, but
that doesn't sound right, Pat.
That's people who have run out of empathy, to be quite honest. Run out of road, run out of empathy. Now, going back to the ambulance services, people waiting for hours and hours for an ambulance to turn up. And David Hall, who runs a private ambulance service, saying, why don't they use us? We could have one right nearby. We can get that person. We can have them treated. And yet they might lie on the floor with a broken hip for 6-7 hours waiting for a public ambulance to be available.
We need to use, as I said earlier on, coming into this winter, we need to use the entire healthcare infrastructure of the state, the entire public system and the entire private system. So if there are opportunities while we're building up the public system to use private providers, we should be using them. When it comes to the National Ambulance Service, the truth is they haven't been given enough money for too many years. They don't have the basis for their staff at the level they need to be at. They don't have enough staff, they don't have enough paramedics, and they don't have sufficient fleet. We're in the middle of changing
that. Even though
that.
We exported some of our older fleet to Ukraine.
Well, they were decommissioned, in fairness, it is a war. So, like, I wouldn't begrudge.
I'm not helping the Ukrainians. I'm just saying they're good enough for the Ukrainians. Perhaps they were good enough still to be running here.
That's a fair point. But really, what we need to be doing is the ambulance service is now is hiring more paramedics, more advanced paramedics, and more modern fleet, and that's the focus at the moment.
Turning to Navan Hospital and the political row over that, the medical director saying, look, we can't keep running a 24/7 emergency department. What we can run is a different kind of minor injuries kind of department, and we can do that very efficiently and do it well. And then politics got in the way. People didn't want it closed. Where does it stand now? Because it looks like the HSE is doing what the doctors want, not necessarily what the politicians want.
Well, the HSE is currently doing what the government have asked them to do, which is to conduct a review. The issue is this. The Navan Hospital team have quite rightly identified a patient safety risk. They've said that Navan Hospital is far too small and has far too few medical specialties to deal with a small number of patients who could be coming in every day, and that represents a real patient risk. And that is true. However, what was the proposal that came to my desk was a solution that worked for Navan Hospital, but didn't necessarily work for the patient. Because I went and I spoke to Drogheda, to their clinical team, and then remember, that's where the patients would go, and said, do you have what you need to treat these patients if we move them? And they said, no, we don't. So what I was never going to stand over was a situation whereby patient risk was simply transferred from one hospital to another, because that doesn't work for the patient.
Poor patient remains in as risky a situation. They go to Navan, they can't be appropriately treated. They go to Drogheda and there isn't the capacity to treat them. Although if they're seriously ill, they will jump the queue. So other patients will suffer the loss, isn't that so?
That is exactly the point. And that is exactly what the Drogheda team put to me. So what did we do? I stepped in and said, we're not moving ahead with any reconfiguration at the moment, because what you have presented is a partial solution. I need to see a regional plan that makes sure that wherever the patient goes, first of all, it's the right place for the patient to go. And secondly, that the place that takes them in has the resources that are required.
Well, we will watch for the results of that review by the HSE. Finally, Mr, on a lighter note, your constituency colleague Simon Harris is the big winner on TikTok. Are you tempted? Because he's in your constituency, and
he is. We actually live quite close to each other. Simon is really good at social media. He is. I started off many years ago with Facebook and Twitter, and I added Instagram, I think, about a year and a half or 2 years ago. So maybe TikTok in some time to come. For now, through this winter, though, the focus is the emergency departments, the waiting lists, COVID, and getting through that. So maybe when we get out the far side of the winter, we can look at expanding to TikTok.
The far side of a reshuffle, who knows?
Sure.
You don't know where you'll be. All right. Stephen Donnelly, Minister for Health, thank you very much for joining us on the programme.
The Pat Kenny Show
with Mater Private Network.
Weekdays at 9 a.m. on News Talk.